Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today my very interesting guest is a man called Jim Green, who is the national nuclear campaigner with Friends of the Earth in Australia and a member of the Energy Science Coalition. Jim has a degree in medical science, an honours degree in public health, and a doctorate degree in science and technology studies for his thesis on the debates over the replacement of the Lucas Heights Nuclear Research Reactor in Sydney, Australia. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Jim.
Thanks, Helen.
Now, Australia is in a very invidious position at the moment. We have 40% of the world's richest uranium, and various moves that have taken place by our national government have created deep concern in many areas. And Jim, you've written eloquently about that. Would you like to outline to the audience exactly where Australia stands now and what these deep concerns are, please, Jim Green?
Yeah, well, I guess probably the main concern is Australia's contribution to nuclear weapons proliferation and the problems there are Australia's alliance with the US and our reliance on the US nuclear weapons umbrella and everything that goes with that, including practical support for the US nuclear warfighting machine and the hosting of US bases in Australia.
You need for the American audience to really fill that out, Jim, to say what our alliance with America means, what our Prime Minister and Obama have just been proposing in terms of the alliance and what the American nuclear umbrella means to us here in Australia in the Pacific Ocean.
So Australia is one of the countries that relies on the US nuclear weapons umbrella, with the others being some NATO states and Japan and South Korea. And that means that we're part of the proliferation problem rather than the solution. And Australia has no need for that sort of nuclear weapons coverage. And because we do rely on it and have ever since the 1950s, it means that Australia plays a pretty ordinary role in international fora on nuclear disarmament. And we're no more serious than the US government is about complete and total and universal nuclear disarmament. So Australia is very much part of the proliferation problem in that sense, and the other big problem is our uranium export policy and our willingness to sell uranium to countries which are nuclear weapons states, which refuse to sign the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, countries that refuse to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, countries blocking the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, and there's a range of other problems with Australia's uranium export policy as well.
Okay, so to be specific, Jim Green, which are the countries to which Australia sells uranium that have not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Well, we sell uranium to Taiwan through a complicated arrangement which goes through the US, but that's seen as something of an anomaly because Taiwan is a non-nuclear weapon state and it presumably would sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty if it was able to do so. But the main problem here is the current proposal to sell uranium to India, which has just been approved by the Labor government and is also supported by the Conservative opposition. And all the problems and precedents that that sets in terms of weakening the NPT and discouraging disarmament and encouraging other countries to pursue nuclear weapons programs on the new understanding that they can do so and still have access to Australian uranium or American reactor technology and so on.
So what are the problems with India and its current nuclear policies?
Well, it's actively embarked on a nuclear arms race with Pakistan, and both countries increased the size of their nuclear weapons arsenals by something like 30% just last year. And they're both still producing fissile material or explosive material for nuclear weapons, both developing ever more powerful and longer-range missiles, both refusing to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And they're basically both rogue nuclear states, and they need to be brought into line rather than being rewarded, as India is, with sales of uranium and reactors and so on.
So now, Jim, how many weapons, nuclear weapons, would India have at this moment?
I'm not entirely sure, but I reckon it's around about 200. You know, there's some uncertainty amongst the people who do their best to get to the bottom of these figures, but it's of that order of magnitude.
And would Pakistan, its long-term enemy, have approximately the same number of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's right.
That's very scary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's scary for so many reasons. You know, political instability in the Indian subcontinent, terrorism, and, of course, we've got a whole new layer of information from WikiLeaks and the sorts of scenarios that have been considered with great alarm amongst diplomats around the world are relatively minor terrorist incidents, such as the Mumbai terror attacks from a year or two ago, escalating into warfare and warfare escalating into nuclear warfare. And not only the immediate and dramatic impacts that would have on the subcontinent, but also the potential for even a relatively limited nuclear warfare between India and Pakistan to cause catastrophic climate change by lifting thousands of tons of soot into the stratosphere. So that's basically the global winter scenario that people have been talking about since the 1970s, but it's been confirmed with a new batch of recent scientific research.
Well, yes, I think they talk about nuclear autumn, actually, after a war between India and Pakistan, inducing the failure of crops throughout the northern and southern hemisphere and causing the death of actually millions or billions of people. That's the scenario. But you write that India and Pakistan get close to war not infrequently, and they have these weapons ready to go. And the situation there, as Pakistan becomes more and more unstable, as we're seeing, we're really feeding a nuclear monster, aren't we, Jim, from Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so there's two plausible positions for Australia to take. One is just to stay out of that mess and not to export uranium to countries involved in nuclear arms races, or not export to nuclear weapon states, full stop. But the other one, to take account of India's situation outside, as a weapon state outside the NPT, is we could sell uranium to India, but on the condition that India curbs its nuclear arms race and curbs its own nuclear weapons program. So we could, for example, insist that India signs the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty as a condition for uranium sales, and India stops the production of fissile material as a condition. The other obvious condition would be a stop to the development of ever longer range missiles as well. But Australia isn't going to apply any of those conditions whatsoever. We're just going to export the WMD feedstock with no conditions, so we're definitely feeding proliferation in South Asia. We're definitely part of the problem rather than the solution.
So why do you think, Jim Green, that the Labor government in Australia, which has always been quite progressive, seemingly, on nuclear weapons proliferation and the like, has decided to take this rather strange tack in terms of proliferation of weapons around the world? What do you think their motivation is?
Well, in India's played a clever diplomatic strategy on this issue. You know, we shouldn't blame all Indians, of course, it's the Indian state. But it's essentially been one of bullying and belligerence and outright refusal to consider any sort of conditions whatsoever that would curb its nuclear weapons program. And I think they're just flexing their economic and political muscle, and Australia has buckled, and I don't think the politics of it go an awful lot deeper than that. There's certainly consideration about supporting India as a counterweight to China. There's some hopes that jobs will be generated in Australia through uranium exports to India, but those hopes will quickly be disappointed because the Indian uranium demand is very small. But essentially, I think it's just Australia caving into the bullying and belligerence of the Indian state.
How have they been belligerent with Australia? I really didn't know that, Jim.
Well, they never miss an opportunity to attack Australia in a nutshell, verbally in any sort of forum, for our refusal to fall into line behind the United States and to allow nuclear trade with India. And so that's the Indian state directly, but also the loosely affiliated commentariat who are a bit more rhetorical. So Australia's being told that we're racist because we won't sell uranium to India. And we've been called all sorts of other names. And it's just become increasingly clear over the past few years that this is going to continue until Australia caves in.
But there's another element, I think, to this, Jim Green, as well, and that is the current and, in fact, past policy of the United States, and particularly stemming from the Pentagon, to isolate China and box China in and surround it with bases. And India, is it not part of that policy of the United States to strengthen India in an effort to defang China in a way? Would you comment on that?
Yeah, that's certainly part of the policy. In particular, it was part of the policy of the US government under George W. Bush, who started this ball rolling back in 2005 with his initial plans to open up nuclear trade with India. But, you know, it's a pretty dangerous game, of course. I mean, one obvious problem that has already arisen as a result of the US-India agreement is that China is using that precedent to justify its plans to sell more reactors to Pakistan. It also creates the basis for closer military and nuclear ties between China and Pakistan. So we're just feeding a circle which is getting ever more dangerous and could end up in catastrophe. And we need to be a lot more cautious and a lot more clever with our politics rather than just falling in line behind George W. Bush, of all people.
Well, now he's out, but what about falling in line behind Obama, who has just visited Australia, and it seems there kind of is a love affair between our Prime Minister Julia Gillard and Obama, and that she seems to be sycophantal and will do anything he suggests. And then you would have to look at Obama himself, who seems to be sycophantal to the Pentagon by supporting its policy to isolate China. Would you like to comment, Jim Green, about what happened when Obama recently visited Australia and addressed the Australian Parliament, in particular in relationship to developing US military bases in Australia, and his comments about China and the Pacific area in general?
Yeah, I didn't follow it in fine detail, but it's part of the general pattern of Australia having a strong military alliance with the US, and that's to be expanded considerably, including our US military bases in the north coast of Australia. And, of course, we've had very significant US bases here, such as Pine Gap, which is a spy and communications facility right in the centre of Australia. And dozens of other bases, US bases, really. So it's an extension of that policy, and that gets back to what we were talking about containment of China and so on and so forth.
Yes, it's very scary. And I think people need to start examining very closely the Pentagon's policy and now the White House's policy about quotes containing China, when China is actually the biggest trading partner of the US, number one. Number two, China supports most of America's foreign debt. But number three, it's being set up by the Pentagon to be the new Cold War enemy because, of course, the Pentagon needs an enemy. And without Russia, now what else would it choose but I suppose China?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. And, you know, China, of course, is a repressive state that could collapse at any stage and break up into a whole lot of different fragments. And that raises a whole set of questions about security of China's nuclear weapons arsenal, creates questions for Australia about whether we can meaningfully safeguard Australia's uranium and its byproducts in China if and when serious and sustained political turmoil starts to unfold. So there's a whole set of questions there, and on a smaller scale, similar problems in Pakistan, which is politically unstable as well.
Yeah, I think you raised two very important points there, Jim, when you look at what's happening as we speak in Russia, where for the first time ever, really, the Russian people are rising up against a repressive regime. And I think the Chinese are very, very scared that a similar situation could occur there. And they've got 1.3 billion people who are fairly well controlled at the moment. But you're right, should they rise up, God knows what will happen.
Yeah, that's right. And with China and India and Pakistan, we haven't seen the nuclear dimensions of this problem to a huge extent yet because they've only got relatively small nuclear power programs. But we've seen in the Middle East a precedent which has probably spread around the world over time, and that is the bombing of nuclear plants with conventional artillery. And so in India, there's that famous 1981 incident when Israel destroyed a reactor in Iraq. Most recently, we've seen Israel destroy a suspected reactor site in Syria in 2007. Iraq was targeting Israel's nuclear plant during the 1991 Gulf War. Iran and Iraq were taking pot shots at each other's nuclear plants during the 1980-88 war. So there's quite a long history of conventional military strikes on nuclear plants in the Middle East. And over time, that's bound to spread to other parts of the world. And if it spreads to South Asia, well, you know, at the moment, there aren't really a very large number of nuclear plants. But countries like China and India and Pakistan have got nuclear power expansion programs, so there could be many more nuclear targets in the coming decades.
I think that's a very relevant point to bring up, Jim Green. I suppose I've said for many years that the Second World War, if fought today, would make Europe uninhabitable for the rest of time because it's so littered with nuclear power plants and, of course, conventional weapons, as you point out, dropping on nuclear power plants would contaminate huge, huge areas permanently with radioactive elements. And it's a thought that I don't think many people have encompassed in terms of Asia and South Asia now, if they were to target each other's reactors. Why would they do that? Would it just be to contaminate areas or to prevent the said country like Pakistan building more bombs? What would be the motivation for China to target India's reactors or Pakistan to target India's reactors or India to target Pakistan's reactors? Why would they do that?
One reason would simply be to disrupt electricity supply, which is a pretty common tactic during warfare.
Yep.
Another would be, I guess you'd call it state terrorism and all the damage and disruption that would inflict on the society that's targeted. And the third one is to prevent further weapons proliferation. So in the Middle East, pretty much all of the conventional military strikes and attempted strikes have been specifically to prevent proliferation. For example, Israel thought that Iraq was going to use a French-supplied reactor to produce plutonium for bombs, so they destroyed that reactor in 1981. And Iraq almost certainly was going to use that reactor to produce plutonium for bombs. But yeah, it's not just proliferation, it's those other issues I mentioned as well, state terrorism and also disruption of energy supply. So, you know, if, say, we can pick any number of countries as examples, but if there's, say, warfare in Northeast Asia, where they do have very large numbers of reactors in South Korea and Japan and elsewhere, then it's a huge dilemma for them. They couldn't turn off their reactors and still power their societies plus a war. And yet they can't leave them on because that makes them sitting ducks for military strikes. So it's a horrendous dilemma. And as you say, Helen, it's one that's not very well appreciated, I don't think.
It's virtually not discussed at all. I mean, even if they turn off their reactors, and now in Japan I think they've only got 7 reactors operating out of their total of 54. But when you turn the reactors off, of course you can still bomb them and release all the radiation inherent in the reactors themselves. So just by stopping the fissile reaction does not mean that they are not legitimate or decent targets for an enemy, does it?
Yeah, that's right. You're just reducing the risk, but you're certainly not negating it altogether.
Let's get back to Pakistan, Jim Green. I just would remind the listeners, Jim Green is a national nuclear campaigner with Friends of the Earth in Australia and a member of the Energy Science Coalition. And Jim has a degree in medical science, an honours degree in public health, and a doctorate in science and technology studies. Pakistan, I wrote a book some years ago called The New Nuclear Danger and looked specifically at Pakistan and the concern there, and I think the concern still is ongoing, that many members of the Pakistani military are Taliban members, and that Pakistan has, as you said earlier, Jim Green, probably up to 200 nuclear weapons now. And the concern by, I know, the Pentagon is that the Taliban could get control of those weapons. Would you like to comment on that scenario?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's entirely possible. There's no doubt about it. You know, on a lesser scale, we saw something similar in India in the late 90s when a far-right demagogic party assumed power. So it doesn't have to be terrorist attacks on the state. It can be taking control of the state. And of course, what happened when the BJP took power in India in the late 90s was one of the first things they did was test nuclear weapons for the first time in India in a quarter of a century. And that had the predictable consequence of Pakistan testing its first ever nuclear weapons. And that really escalated the nuclear arms race in South Asia quite considerably. So, yeah, I mean, there's scenarios where the state loses its control of its own nuclear weapons, or where radicals assume state power. And, it's just the absolute nightmare scenarios with global consequences in terms of the direct effects that nuclear weapons can have, but also that nuclear winter or nuclear autumn type scenario.
Yes, and at the moment, Zardari, who is the present Prime Minister of Pakistan, who is not necessarily not corrupt, is in trouble too. And so Pakistan is a very unstable state. And then we've got the added complication of America having its drones overhead in Pakistan and bombing certain targets, even though it's not at war with Pakistan. And then the Pakistanis blocking the access of NATO troops going into Afghanistan because they're very annoyed with the drone attacks. That whole mess associated with Afghanistan and Pakistan and the drones and the killing of Osama bin Laden, which annoyed many Pakistanis, has really added fuel to the fire, nuclear flame, would you say, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. And as the WikiLeaks cables have been reminding us, you know, there's a potential for relatively small incidents to escalate into warfare and for that to escalate into nuclear warfare. And, you know, these sort of scenarios only have to unfold once and you've got regional catastrophe and potentially global catastrophe.
And the other thing is I find fascinating, you know, the nuclear physicist A.Q. Khan, who initiated really the nuclear program in Pakistan and who set up the nuclear Walmart by selling nuclear-related goods to many countries outside Pakistan. He's a national hero, and their nuclear weapons are kind of seen as a symbol, a potent symbol of their nationalism. Would you like to comment on that, Jim Green?
Yeah, well, it's a huge problem, isn't it? In, not only in South Asia, but with the other nuclear weapon states as well. And the A.Q. Khan network, there's so many lessons there, but we shouldn't forget that he initially stole uranium enrichment technology from Uranco, which was a European nuclear power consortium. So it's yet another case where we see the overlap between supposedly peaceful nuclear programs and military programs. And again, that's just such an important problem, and it's one that Australia needs to be focused on as well, because of our own history. Our one and only push for nuclear power was way back in the 1960s, and that was definitely motivated by a weapons agenda. And India, of course, got that reactor from Canada and promised not to use it to produce nuclear bombs, and promptly did so and tested its first nuclear bomb in 1974. So, yeah, and we're seeing talk of a nuclear renaissance around the world. It hasn't happened yet, but there's still talk of many more countries developing nuclear power capabilities. And unfortunately, with that capability comes a nuclear weapons capability. And historically, we've seen so many cases of peaceful nuclear programs spilling over into military programs that it's an enormous concern. And you know, to bring it back to Australia, we need to be part of the solution rather than the problem. So if we're going to export uranium, and Friends of the Earth certainly argues that we shouldn't, but if we are, then there have to be some standards. You can't sell uranium to nuclear weapon states, to countries refusing to sign the Test Ban Treaty, to countries that are developing nuclear-capable missiles and so on and so forth. It's incredibly irresponsible.
It is, Jim. And so would you like to talk about the International Atomic Energy Agency's inspection programs, where it's supposed to go in and keep a close eye on countries to make sure that they're not diverting plutonium from their peaceful nuclear reactors to making nuclear weapons? Talk about their inspection program, their financial problems. How reliable is the inspection program, and how that applies particularly and specifically to India?
Yeah, well, the recently retired head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, is Mohammed El Baradei, and he summed up the problems quite neatly. He said their basic inspection rights are fairly limited. The system suffers from vulnerabilities. Efforts to improve it have been half-hearted, and they run the safeguard system on a shoestring budget comparable to a local police department. So that language is coming directly from the head of the organisation responsible for safeguards, and their safeguard system basically revolves around periodic inspections of some nuclear plants. So it's essentially a random audit sort of a system. And safeguards are particularly weak in the nuclear weapon states because the IAEA has neither the resources nor the inclination to seriously implement safeguards in weapon states. So that will apply in India, where there will either be token safeguards inspections or quite possibly there will be none at all. And a recent example of that was uranium sales to Russia, where we were told that strict safeguards would ensure peaceful use of Australian uranium. But then we found out that safeguards in Russia are virtually non-existent. There was one inspection of one plant in 2001 and another inspection in 2010. But for all intents and purposes, safeguards in Russia are non-existent. And in China, they're tokenistic. And we're certainly not getting any protection that Australian uranium will end up only being used for peaceful purposes.
Yes, and isn't it true, Jim, that India will allow inspection of its peaceful reactors but won't allow inspection of its reactors which are specifically allocated to produce plutonium for weapons?
Yeah, well, India can pick and choose what plants come under safeguards and what don't. So it's of its nuclear power reactors, its current reactors and those under construction, it will allow safeguards on 14 of them, but refuse safeguards on 8 of them. So presumably those 8 reactors are in some way connected to India's nuclear weapons program, or it might be that India is simply reserving them for potential use in the weapons program. And we hear so much rhetoric these days about new reactor designs and Generation 4 reactors and so on. And I think it's important to note that India's entire advanced nuclear program, quote-unquote, involving thorium and plutonium, that's been kept out of safeguards. So that is definitely part of its weapons program, as well as whatever interest they have in developing novel types of nuclear power.
Yeah, now you've hit on a very important topic, and that's thorium. The nuclear advocates are saying, you know, we might run out of uranium, but we'll never run out of thorium, and why don't we get into thorium reactors? Jim, I'd like you to outline for the audience what thorium reactors are, what the problem with thorium is, and just so that they understand quite deeply what the nuclear industry is talking about when it refers to thorium reactors.
Well, essentially, they're experimental reactors. There certainly aren't any large-scale thorium power reactors. But at the moment, it's really just hopes and rhetoric. They're some decades away from being deployed, if ever. And unfortunately, they carry with them much the same problems as conventional uranium reactors. And in particular, there's no reason to believe that they're going to be any better with respect to nuclear weapons proliferation. And the problems are that when you irradiate thorium in a reactor, it produces uranium-233, which can be and has been used in nuclear weapons. So the US has certainly successfully tested a uranium-233 weapon. India may have itself in 1998. No one's really sure. And thorium reactors could also very easily be used to irradiate uranium or depleted uranium targets to produce plutonium. And the third proliferation problem with thorium reactors is that they needed to be kick-started because the thorium itself is not a fissile isotope, so they need to be kick-started either with a particle accelerator, which might be a clever way to do it, or alternatively kick-started with fissile material, so highly enriched uranium or plutonium. So that will give countries an excuse to get their hands on highly enriched uranium or plutonium, which could be diverted for direct use in nuclear weapons.
That's very nicely put, Jim. There are two other points to make too, that because thorium itself is not naturally fissionable and you have to kickstart it with, as you said, what was the first thing you said?
Either a particle accelerator or fissile material
like highly enriched uranium or plutonium, it's very expensive, so it's not an easy material to use, number one. Number two, uranium-233, apart from being fissile itself and can be used for weapons, is very dangerous. It's highly, highly radioactive and terribly, terribly dangerous to handle. And because of the problems you enunciated and the ones I've just said, it is true that no country has entered into developing thorium reactors. The reason I talk about thorium is that it's fairly plentiful on the Earth's crust, and particularly in India, and we've got it too in Australia. But they're very expensive, they're difficult to create, proliferation problems, they're very dangerous, and the like. So it's a dream that physicists have and will continue to have, I guess. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, Jim, is to which countries right now does Australia export its uranium?
To the US and to Japan and South Korea and to a number of the European Union countries.
And Russia?
And, there are a number of smaller customer countries. And they include Russia and China and possibly India in the not-so-distant future. and Taiwan, of course, but the main customers are the US, Japan, South Korea and European Union countries.
And isn't it true, I think, that someone from Australia who's in the know said the other day that most of the uranium in the Fukushima reactors 1 to 6 was Australian uranium?
I don't know about most of it, but some of it certainly was, and we've had that acknowledged by the Australian government now. And the problem there is that Australia and the Australian uranium mining companies have turned a blind eye over the past decade, even when it was revealed in 2002 that there were over 200 incidents of safety breaches and data falsification in Japanese nuclear utilities. And then 5 years later in 2007, revelations of a further 87 incidents of safety breaches and data falsification. So Australia has simply turned a blind eye to those problems and continued to export uranium to Japan without any requirement whatsoever for Japan to improve its safety standards or to tighten the regulatory system or to do anything that might have prevented the catastrophe of Fukushima.
Are we legally supposed to enforce standards to make sure the countries are adhering to tight safety standards? I thought all we could do was enforce the fact that countries should not make weapons from our uranium.
Well, Australia could do it through bilateral agreements. Australia requires all uranium customer countries to sign a bilateral agreement, and they contain some useful clauses like Australia insists on prior consent before plutonium is separated from spent fuel, which is a really good, strong, strict policy. The problem is that it's never once been implemented. So in Japan, for example, we've given Japan open-ended permission to separate and stockpile plutonium, which definitely fans regional proliferation tensions and risks in Northeast Asia. But for safety, we could easily include clauses and conditions in those bilateral safety agreements, which insist on a minimum level of safety performance. And a reasonable regulatory regime and so on. So there would certainly be mechanisms for doing it, even if it's not standard practice at the moment.
Yeah, it needs to be standard practice. So now let's talk about separation of plutonium, which, of course, is the fuel for nuclear weapons. How much plutonium, Jim Green, has Japan now stockpiled?
Well, I'm only guessing, but it would have to be getting up to something like 100 tonnes. The UK has got the biggest so-called civil plutonium stockpile, and I think that's 114 tonnes. But we're talking about massive amounts, so 100 tonnes of plutonium would be enough for about 10,000 nuclear weapons. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that all that plutonium is going to end up in nuclear weapons, but, you know, only the tiniest fraction of it has to be diverted, and Japan would have a significant nuclear weapons arsenal. And as I mentioned, Japan's plutonium stockpiling, that makes Northeast Asian nuclear politics all that much more complicated. It makes it much harder to stop South Korea from developing a plutonium reprocessing program. It complicates the dynamics with Taiwan. North Korea is also a huge problem with their so-called experimental power reactor that they use to produce plutonium for bombs. Australia simply should refuse permission for any Australian-obligated plutonium to be separated and stockpiled. It's a simple solution to that problem, and Japan doesn't even need stockpiles of separated plutonium. It only pursues that program because it gives it an option of sending the spent fuel overseas to European reprocessing plants for some decades. So it's an out-of-sight, out-of-mind strategy.
You mean to get rid of their spent irradiated fuel for a while until it comes back as separated plutonium. What happens to the other waste that is developed from reprocessing, Jim Green?
Well, that's shipped back to Japan as well. So we get these global shipments of spent fuel going from Japan to Europe, and going in the other direction you get high-level nuclear waste shipments plus plutonium shipments going back to Japan.
And what is Japan doing with its high-level nuclear waste? Must have a hell of a lot of it.
Yeah, it does, and it's like so many other countries, it's still stockpiling it, and there are...
Where?
At reactor sites primarily, as I understand
liquid?
It.
Is it liquid?
No, this would be solid material. And
is it calcined? I mean, what sort of solid material is a high-level waste?
Yeah, I must admit I'm not sure, Helen. I'm guessing that it would be vitrified in France.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm not sure how they would treat it at Sellafield. So I'm not sure, actually.
Vitrified means turned into glass, which is not the solution. So you're telling me, I hadn't thought of this, Jim, that they've got not only over 100 tonnes of plutonium stockpiled, but they must have massive amounts of high-level radioactive waste stored in an earthquake-prone country throughout the country, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. The other question that we need to examine too, Jim, is that as Japan is a highly technological country, as we all know, it is true that within weeks, if Japan so decided, it could produce nuclear weapons. I mean, I'm sure it's got the drawing boards ready to go and the equipment ready to go, and if it wanted to, it could easily produce a number of nuclear weapons over a short period of time, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That must scare the bejesus out of China, for instance.
It certainly feeds into the problem. So you could call Japan a de facto nuclear weapon state.
Mm.
It's one of a number of countries. There are some others in Western Europe that have got advanced nuclear power programs plus missile and delivery capabilities. And for all intents and purposes, they're effectively weapon states.
Which ones are those, Jim Green?
Well, Germany would certainly fall within that category, and several others, I guess.
You don't want to name them?
I couldn't really think of them off the top of my head.
Not Italy, I suppose.
No, Italy would be some distance behind.
And France has already got its nuclear weapons.
Yeah. I think it's worth noting that it is, a pretty major enterprise to build nuclear weapons. And as an example of that, Iraq in the 1970s and 80s, employed thousands of people on their nuclear weapons program, and they had a very large budget to play with. But they failed. They failed to develop a mechanism to produce large quantities of fissile material, and they were also failing in their efforts to weaponize fissile material to turn that explosive material into a functioning nuclear weapon. So it's not straightforward, but for countries like Germany and Japan with advanced nuclear programs, they would certainly have the expertise to do that.
It's very straightforward, yes.
But by counterpoint, Australia had a lot of expertise in the 1960s, but that's gradually whittled away. So Australia is a very long way away from a weapons capability across a range of fronts. The basic expertise would be the main limitation, but also you would get material constraints on our very limited capacity to produce fissile material, and I doubt that we've got the expertise to weaponise material. And then there would be a further set of questions with weapons delivery as well.
I'm interviewing Jim Green, who's the national nuclear campaigner with Friends of the Earth in Australia, a member of the Energy Science Coalition. And Jim has a degree in medical science, an honours degree in public health, and a doctorate in science and technological studies. Now, Jim, you wrote an excellent paper about selling Australian uranium abroad, and you brought up the fact that with the quotes nuclear renaissance still pending, that we could be selling to the United Arab Emirates and other countries. Would you like to talk about what other potential customers there are for Australian uranium?
Well, there's a good dozen or so countries in the Middle East which have been talking about developing nuclear power plants for the first time. And it's really alarming because of the politics of the Middle East and the nuclear politics in particular, that history of conventional military strikes on nuclear plants, the large number of covert nuclear weapons programs which have been pursued in the Middle East. Only Israel went the whole way and actually developed nuclear weapons, but there have been others who have systematically pursued covert nuclear weapons programs and often done that under cover of a peaceful nuclear program. So it's just a disastrous situation which is looming, but whether it's the Middle East or the so-called global nuclear renaissance, you know, we can take some comfort from the fact that it's simply not happening at the moment, and Fukushima has further stalled it. So, you know, these problems haven't materialised yet, but it's only because the nuclear renaissance hasn't materialised either. So, you know, let's hope that it stays that way, because there's no way that you could have a comfortable, simple, straightforward deployment of nuclear power throughout the Middle East without that feeding into a whole set of proliferation problems.
Yes, I read the other day that Saudi Arabia in fact stated that it would like to make nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well, you know, those sorts of comments are not uncommon throughout the Middle East and North Africa as well. And, you know, it feeds back into the US-India deal as well. That weakening of standards has encouraged Iran to continue to pursue its nuclear weapons program. And that creates a precedent and an excuse for other countries in the Middle East to push ahead initially with nuclear power programs, but with every intent of using that expertise and that hardware to produce weapons further down the track.
Would you like to address the Iran situation, Jim? That there's a lot of talk about that now. People are saying that Iran's, you know, making nuclear weapons. There's a new report that's come out of the IAEA. Would you like to comment about it, the Iranian situation, Jim Green?
Well, I think it's clear enough that there has been some military intent in Iran's program. You know, one of the difficulties is it's impossible to say whether an enrichment program definitely is driven by a military agenda or by a peaceful agenda, but there's enough reason to be concerned about Iran's intentions. I suspect that, like a lot of other countries, Iran is really interested in a hedge. It's interested in having the capability to produce nuclear weapons. It doesn't necessarily want to produce the nuclear weapons themselves. But, of course, the concern there is the politics of the Middle East, and Israel also already has its nuclear weapons arsenal, and other countries could follow suit. And this in a very politically volatile region and a region with a history of conventional military strikes on nuclear plants.
Yes, a study was done by Physicians for Social Responsibility a few years ago to say, should Israel use two nuclear weapons, penetrating weapons, on the three uranium enrichment facilities in Iran, in Nahant, Isfahan, and I can't remember where the other one was, in order to destroy them, resulting cloud of radioactive material would be blown over to Pakistan and would kill, I can't remember how many million, about 6 million, I think, from memory. So things are pretty scary, aren't they? And Israel, he's been making noises that it might go alone to destroy those facilities without even asking permission or working with the United States.
Yeah, but as Israel would know, you know, they can certainly delay the Iranian nuclear program, but they can't stop it. It's just not physically possible to stop it, even if you're prepared to use nuclear weapons to destroy all of Iran's nuclear plants and nuclear research facilities. It just wouldn't work as a strategy.
Why?
Because those plants are scattered across numerous different sites. Some of them would be well protected, but I think the main limitation is that it's the expertise that is the crucial factor in all of this, and you can't destroy the expertise. You know, you're talking about computer software and cadres of technicians and scientists and so on. You know, you don't deal with that problem simply by taking out a uranium enrichment plant, for example.
Yeah. So, Jim, after this litany of pretty scary scenarios, what's your prognosis?
Well, you know, something vaguely resembling the status quo. I guess we might even accept that if we were given the option, given that the alternatives are a whole lot worse. But, you know, this nuclear renaissance is not happening, and it might happen, but I suspect that it will be a bit of a damp squib, and that probably in 30 years' time, there will only be a handful more countries with nuclear power.
Mm.
And since the nuclear renaissance is not happening to any significant degree, the weapons situation will probably be a similar sort of standoff to what we see today, with maybe another one or two nuclear weapon states, but without the cascade of proliferation that we worry might happen alongside a nuclear power renaissance. So I suspect some sort of a holding pattern, but in situations like the South Asian nuclear arms race, you know, it's certainly plausible that that could get out of control.
We could India see and nuclear Pakistan, weapons. Yeah.
Yeah, that we could see nuclear weapons being used. And also, Northeast Asia is such a volatile situation, with North Korea having tested nuclear weapons and China having nuclear weapons and Japan and South Korea being de facto nuclear weapon states and so on.
Yes, and then finally, Jim Green, what is your prognosis for the accident at Fukushima?
Well, I think in terms of human radiation exposure, the only study I've seen suggested radiation exposure about 1% of what Chernobyl was, but that was based on the initial Japanese government estimates of radiation releases, which have since been increased quite considerably. So, you know, we're only dealing in guesstimates at the moment, but I'm guessing that the death toll might be in the range of somewhere between a few hundred and a few thousand long-term cancer deaths. And the other issue is the horrendous impacts on the 100,000 people who have had to be evacuated, and the loss of livelihood for them, and the health impacts. And we saw a pretty dramatic illustration of that on Australian TV just the other day, with a Japanese farmer who's lost his farm because it's contaminated, so he's lost his livelihood, his family's moved to the cities. And the sting in the tail was that this farmer's neighbour was in exactly the same situation, but he had committed suicide just recently.
Mm.
So we're dealing with an extraordinary amount of human suffering.
Mm.
And an incredibly blasé attitude from the nuclear industry, who are trying to pretend that this is a minor industrial accident.
And what about the prognosis for the ongoing accident? What would you say about that, Jim Green?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of what-if scenarios with the Fukushima reactors, but, you know, unless there's another major disturbance, such as another major earthquake or tsunami affecting those reactors, I think they'll probably manage to keep them fairly stable, but, you know, there are risks there, but the risks certainly decrease over time, simply through the process of radioactive decay, making the whole site a little bit less radioactive as every day goes by.
Yes, I've been interviewing a wonderful nuclear engineer called Arne Gundersen from the United States frequently on the program, and he keeps us up to date with all the latest details of the ongoing accident. Well, Jim, it's been wonderful and very interesting to talk to you today, and I'm sure you've given a lot of food for thought for our listeners who are really hungry for this sort of information. So I thank you very much for coming on the program.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Helen.
Thanks, Jim. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Jim Green, who is a national nuclear campaigner with Friends of the Earth and a member of the Energy Science Coalition. Jim has a degree in medical science, an honours degree in public health, and a doctorate in science and technology studies. Thank you for listening. I'm sure you had much food for thought in that interview, and we'll be back with you next week for another fascinating in-depth discussion. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.